So what I want to do for the next few minutes is try and tie up some loose ends. I left a couple of things hanging last week related to the idea of responsibility, and that will be really important for what we're going to do today. So I want to talk just briefly about a few of these loose ends, then what we're going to do going forward. I want to make two more points sort of in this vein, and then we're going to turn and try and do some case studies. Okay, so background here, when I got the email or whatever from, I think it was Mother Rebecca asking me to do this class this fall, they mentioned, she or father, I don't know, somebody mentioned the TV show The Good Place. Have you watched this show, The Good Place? I really recommend it. It's a lovely show. And so what happens is, I'm not spoiling this, they're all dead. I mean, I'm spoiling it in the sense that you would learn this in the first 2 minutes. But the entire show, for the most part, takes place in the afterlife of some variety. And one of the characters is a professor of moral philosophy, which is not a character that you normally see in any show, much less a sitcom. And what's really impressive about this, from my perspective anyway, is that he's good. He knows his stuff. So in one of the first, or I think it's in the first season, in a 1 or 2 minute summary, he summarizes Kant's Metaphysics of Morals. And it's about the best summary of the Metaphysics of Morals that I've ever heard of. So the idea was something like we would do something on, you know, ethics that would sort of draw on or at least like be inspired by the TV show The Good Place. There's an inherent limitation to this, though, in that we are all alive and finite. And so one of the ways that the show operates in different scenarios is that they can run simulations, moral simulations, as it were. So one of the most famous of all ethics cases is what's called the trolley case. You heard of the trolley case? The trolley case is this. All right, you're a person who works a lever and you control where the trains go, right? There's a train coming down the tracks and there's a kid stuck on the track. Do you pull the lever? And the track on the other side goes off a cliff. It's not complete, so it goes off a cliff. Do you pull the lever and save the one kid? You know, wonderful, beautiful little kid. Looks like my kid, right? Whatever. You should have deep, you know, emotional attachment to this kid. Do you pull the lever and save that kid and let the train go off? Or do you not pull the lever and let the train... So what do you do? Huh? Flip. Why do you flip? How many people are on the train? I don't know. Here's one of the points about running this case is that it really doesn't matter how many people are on the train. Right? Once you get to two, you've got an obvious like calculation if you're a utilitarian. Two is better than one. You save the two lives. Now, what if the two lives are Adolf Hitler and Mother Teresa? What do you do then? I mean, you can run this in any, like, an endless variety of scenarios. So what happens in The Good Place is that, and this I am spoiling, so, you know, whatever. They run an entire show, one episode dedicated to the trolley case, where they run this simulation in multiple different varieties so that the people are actually having, because, you know, they're in eternity. They can do whatever they want. So they run this. Anyway, I can't run the trolley scenario for you where you're actually on a train or you're the conductor or you're the one pulling it. But what we're going to try and do for the next few weeks as we move forward here is to, as it were, so one way that you can teach ethics is actually by case studies. I'm not actually going to bring in case studies. I mentioned it first about the possibility of bringing in op-eds from different sides of, you know, different perspectives, that sort of stuff. If you're interested in that, we can talk about it. But I'm going to show you in a little bit what I'm going to try and do, at least for this week. But before we do that, let's tie up a few loose ends, okay? So last week I mentioned the concept of responsibility as it comes from 20th century ethicists, especially I've mentioned Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And what I did not do is actually tell you sort of the way that we can use responsibility, so as a form of moral reason. So we talked about rules, we've talked about goals, we've talked about virtues, right? These are approaches to making choices. And responsibility I'm offering as one that sort of captures a few of the pieces of those three, but it's its own sort of approach. And we'll come back to that in just a minute when we start to transition to talk about cases. So that's what's coming in a minute. What I want to suggest is that I also left hanging last week. I said, what is a moral question? What's a moral topic? And I gave you a quick case study of a pastor who was asked to do the funeral of a really racist, as the man's son said, asshole. So what do you do, right? Should you do this? Does it violate your own moral principles, your own integrity, like whatever? What do you do? So, and then I just close with saying, that's a moral problem. But what makes it a moral problem? Clearly there's a conflict between what it is that we value or we think we value or the values that we hold, right? Our own belief that racism is deeply wrong and our own belief that God loves sinners, right? To whom we are supposed to minister as, you know, a pastor or something. So there are conflicts in our own way of viewing the good or the right, and this brings about a moral question. Does that make sense? And we can sort of see a tension in our own values. But more to the point for what's coming in the next few weeks. So if you picked up one of these like a few weeks ago, the topics are politics, war, the economy, the family, immigration, and then I'll do a sort of closing week on Anglican approaches to moral theology. What makes politics, war, the economy, the family, and immigration, I take to be sort of paradigms of decent moral questions, like topics for moral inquiry, are a couple of things. First, I mentioned last week Bonhoeffer's idea of the mandates, right? So there's government, there's family, something called culture, and the church. And these are just what other theologians and thinkers have called estates or spheres or realms or whatever. They're the kind of form that our intrinsic sociality takes. We are creatures who need some sort of political order. We are bound to families. We are religious beings, or in Bonhoeffer's idea, churchly beings. And we exist in a multitude of overlapping cultural institutions as well. And so if you notice this list of topics, politics, war, the economy, the family, immigration, these all exist within those sorts of spheres or mandates. And for Bonhoeffer, these are mandates that God has set in place. God mandated them, brought them into being after the fall as a way of ordering our disordered desires, right? You see this in the fundamental sort of exchange between Adam and Eve, right? Like, your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you, right? And so God puts in place an actual, like, sort of order of family to make sure that these disordered desires between husband and wife, family and child, right? This is how the Old Testament closes. He will send someone who will turn the hearts of the children to their father and the hearts of the father to their children. God is in the business of ordering our disordered loves, our disordered desires. And these are the ways, families and governments and cultural institutions and the church, that we bring order to the chaos of our lives. We exist in these overlapping institutions, and each one of these topics sort of fits into those. Does that make sense so far? Okay. The other thing that they have in common, and this is going to be really tricky, is that they all participate in a fundamental, sort of intrinsic asymmetry of power. And this is a challenge for us because we're not prone to accepting asymmetries of power unless we're the one with more of it. Right? But each one of these ways of ordering our lives depend on intrinsic asymmetries of power. Parents and children. The rulers and the ruled. Right? In the cultural sphere or the economic sphere, like bosses and employees, right? These are all fundamental and intrinsic asymmetries of power, relationships in which the power is not symmetrical. It's not equal. It's asymmetrical. So I want to suggest that we sort of position ourselves then between two extreme possibilities. One is to say, to hell with it all, because we are fundamentally equalitarian or egalitarian in our approach, right? So no intrinsic asymmetries of power. And the other is to say, don't worry about asymmetries of power at all, because they're just good. That's what brings order to our chaos, right? No, there's a tension here that says we need to be really attentive to any relationship in which there's an intrinsic asymmetry of power, but at the same time not throw it away just because that's the case. That's one sort of middle ground that I want us to try and hold as we move forward, is to think about what makes, is there an injustice to the asymmetry of power, or can asymmetries of power be just? Does that make sense? Are we clear? Any questions? That's not a conversation stopper. That's a real question. Any questions?
Maybe it's a real question, but isn't the asymmetrical thing of power, isn't that a bit organic by just the nature of leadership? That's kind of bound to happen.
Well, organic would probably be doing the same function there as intrinsic for me. Okay. I mean, like, it's inescapable, right? Parents do have they do exercise authority over their children that children do not exercise over their parents. However, if you have toddlers, you might know that children also exercise tyrannical sorts of powers over their parents, requiring you to do things like go to six-year-old birthday parties on Saturday in college football season. Like, think about that. That's cruel and unusual. Okay, so these take place within these sort of spheres that order our life. These questions arise. And they are spheres in which the relationships are intrinsically asymmetrical. There's an intrinsic asymmetry of power. So today's topic is politics. And politics is probably the most paradigmatic case of intrinsic asymmetries of power. Because you exercise power on behalf of others, including if you're like a politician with genuine authority, you exercise the power of life and death, right? So you might tell your child in a moment of fury, like, child, I brought you into this world and I'll take you out, right? Not that any of you would say that. But if you are someone who actually has the power to say, right, thumbs down in the arena of, you know, a gladiator or something, you actually do exercise the power of life and death. You send troops into battle. You make decisions that affect, even when you're making, you know, tax decisions, you're affecting like life and death situations for people who might not have access to clean water. All right, so here I think is where responsibility helps us think critically about how politics works, okay? So responsibility can have three different valences at least. The first is a response to God. So God calls and we respond. That's what a responsibility, that's one version of a responsibility ethics. God calls and we respond to God's call, and this is where we get the idea of a vocation. So God doesn't just call people to the priesthood. God calls people to whatever, right? And we do whatever we do, heartily, as unto the Lord. So response to God, and we do that in our life. We respond to God in our life in every facet of our life. There's also an older version of responsibility, that is to say, who is the responsible party here? And you get this in the cases like before courts, right? Who's responsible for this? Or when the parent comes home from vacation and sees that there's been a party at the house, like the question is, who did this, right? Who is the responsible party? So you're called to give an account of yourself as the responsible party, to take responsibility for an action. And then the third valence is related. It's to be a responsible party in the sense of a proactive, to realize that it's your responsibility to do this thing, to make this choice. And so politicians, leaders, governmental officials have responsibilities. They exercise responsibility. This is really important for us as we think about politics as a moral question in Christian ethics for this reason. Well, for a lot of reasons, but this one in particular. We have to ask ourselves in any given political situation, who is responsible here? More to the point, we need to ask ourselves, for what are we responsible? And more to the point than that, we need to know what that word "we" means. Who are we? Who are we talking about? Are we talking about us as individuals? Us as citizens of a country? Us as a church? And each one of these different sort of positions that we can occupy can change the answer that we give to the question, what are we to do? So, one question for Christian ethics is, are we trying to give an answer to the question, what should we do for people as people? Or are we trying to give an answer to the question, what should we do for the church? So what should we do when confronted with this political situation? All right, so going forward, starting now, we're going to begin talking about, like, we're going to try and put this into practice a little bit, right? And the way we're going to do this is by putting a couple of questions on the table, or a couple of cases or examples on the table, and then working through the sort of big apparatus that I've given you over the first 3 weeks in really simple ways. So we'll ask ourselves, what are the rules, or what is the rule that should be applied here? What are the goals that we should be seeking here that would tell us what's the right thing to do? What kind of virtues would we need to see, like, to do the right thing, or moral exemplar? Like, can we find someone from history, like a saint, for instance, who's done something similar in this situation? And then ask ourselves, so what are we responsible for? And then give answers in these sort of three different ways, right? What are we responsible for? In this case, it's politics. So what are we responsible for as citizens? So you can say that as, you know, citizens. As individuals, because there are times when our, like, loyalties to the government should come under our, like, ideas of what it means to be a good person, right? And then what should we do as the church?
Is that social responsibility that we're trying to say is who we're responsible for?
Well, that would be one other piece of it. What I mean is, what do we have the authority to do? What are we sort of obliged to do for the sake of others? Each week going forward, I'm also going to drop in a couple of other sort of tools in the tool belt. So I've given you these broad themes, right? This week, I want to give you two more tools, ways of thinking about answering these questions. These come from Catholic social teaching. And this will get at your question, okay? The first is solidarity. So solidarity means that we don't just, like, look around and see what's going on, but that we are sort of close with the people that we're making decisions about. So we're in solidarity with people. In other words, we don't just give money to poverty relief. We actually are trying to live with the poor or something. That would be one example. The other principle that goes into Catholic social teaching on this, so talking about the social relationships here, is subsidiarity. You might have heard, did I talk about this before? I've talked about, no? Okay. So subsidiarity, you probably heard, if you've heard it at all, from Paul Ryan, and his version of it is a very odd one. But subsidiarity is basically the idea that whatever institutional level is the lowest that can handle the problem, that institutional level should handle it. So if the individual can actually address a moral problem, then it should not be up to the state. Or if the family can address a moral problem, it should not be up to the state or the church or whatever, right? So there are different levels of institutional, they get bigger and bigger and bigger. And some of these then, and this is the point that I think that Ryan misses, some of these actually are the responsibility of the bigger institution, right? There are problems that are too large for small corporations to fix. Like big corporations, for instance, are a problem that are too big for you and me to fix. We need the state to govern them, to regulate them, right? International commerce is a problem that we can't handle here at Transfiguration. So The question for subsidiarity, and this is the question of responsibility that I'm trying to get at here, the question is, who or at what level? Who is the proper agent, or at what level do we find the proper agency to deal with the problem at hand? Right? The classic example here for, like, if we keep it in sort of terms we've been using with Bonhoeffer and stuff, would be the Hitler Youth, right? You should not use the state to train children. That's the job of the family. It's a violation not only of the integrity of the mandate of the family, it's a violation of the principle of subsidiarity, because the state's role is not to regulate children. That's the family's role, to train them, to nurture them, to bring them up in virtue. So subsidiarity asks, who is the proper agent, or at what level do we find the proper agency for the size of the problem at hand? Any questions so far? All right, everybody take a deep breath. All right, so I've been debating this all week in my head. I first thought, what if we talked about the impeachment of President Trump? That's the biggest political problem that we're all aware of at the moment, right? Or at least it's one of them. It's the most obvious, and you've got a sort of set of real things that you can sink your teeth into. The political problem that I've been thinking about as one that we could talk about, though, is actually one that was debated a few years ago, several years ago, which is water rights between Oklahoma and Texas. Much lower to the ground, right? That case is already settled in the courts, which is to say that we can't go and take their water. Victory for states' rights. Interesting, isn't it, that Texas was like the victim of a states' rights verdict? All right, so what I decided to do was punt, which is a really effective pedagogical tool. Like, in the classroom, the more you can punt, the better off you'll be. And here's how this is going to work then. You're going to decide. So in your small groups, like, find, I don't know, 5, 6, whatever you think is small, people at your table. You've only got you at your table, so you're a constituency of one, but you could join others. And I'm going to give you about 3 minutes, okay? And you're going to get to debate which of these two we talk about. We can talk about, like, really of the moment, high-level political intrigue, or we can talk about water rights. And this is the third option, this is more punting, you can come up with another one. All right, and then we're going to do this in a real democratic way, which is to say the tyranny of majority rule. We'll vote on it by blocks. So, right? So gather up amongst yourselves. I'll give you about 3 minutes. All right, finish up. Okay, are we getting close?
Yes.
Over here?
Yes.
How are y'all? This table? Getting close? 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 All right. What say you? Gerrymandering. Okay.
Wow.
Impeachment? Yeah. Impeachment. Water rights. Democracy at work. Okay. Impeachment it is. All right. You want to know the real challenge here? Figuring out what the question is. This is a real challenge, not just for this one, particularly for this one, but it's a real challenge for a lot of things. Sometimes we know what the question is because it's the question that drives us, sort of presents itself in very obvious form, and that's what makes us realize we're doing ethics. So I said last week that for Bonhoeffer, the world on the whole, when it's as it should be, more or less, right, is conducive to our flourishing. He kind of trusts the world, and think about this. This is a guy who's writing at the very peak of Nazi power, and knows about it. He knows about the atrocities. His brother-in-law is at a really high level of government and this sort of stuff, and so he knows about the atrocities. He knows all of it. He knows about the terror. His family has been subject to it. And as he's reflecting on the world, he really does believe that God has put it in order in such a way that when it's flourishing, it is conducive to our happiness. It's a really telling thing, right? Because for those of us who are surrounded by political intrigue and watching the decline of our institutions and that sort of stuff, it's easy to become pessimistic about this politics as an enterprise at all. But for a guy who is in the middle of the worst downfall of Western, European civilization or whatever in history, he still thinks that that's the way the world is set up, that God put it in place, that when everything is as it should be, it's conducive to our flourishing, such that, and this is the reason I'm bringing it up, on the whole, we never even notice that we're doing ethics. We never even notice that we're making really important moral choices throughout our lives. The reason is because the world is set up to help move us along, to propel us through the world in such a way that we can see what we're supposed to do as we go along. So the way I put it last week, is look, it's not an eternal law that you should celebrate Mother's Day, right? Hallmark made up Mother's Day. But it is the case that if you're in a society or a culture in which Mother's Day is an important thing, you just call your mom on Mother's Day. That's one of the things that a good person does. And all the moms said, yeah. Right? So sometimes then, there's such a tear in the moral fabric of the world as we navigate it, that the question just dramatically presents itself. It's an either or. Should I do this or should I do that? But oftentimes, there are what some philosophers call wicked problems, which is just where the cords and the threads and the layers are all overwhelmingly interlayered, and to pull one of them is to watch all of them unravel in different ways. And at that point, the first order of business is to ask ourselves, well, what is really going on? This is what Reinhold Niebuhr was famous for, or one of the things, he was a Christian ethicist in the 20th century. What is really going on? That's the first question in ethics. Look around and take stock. What's really going on? And one way that you take stock is to say, well, who has skin in the game? So Niebuhr was famous for paying real attention to real power, right? Who has the money? Who has the firepower in international relationships? And that will tell you a lot about what's really going on. What does Russia want out of this? Is a good question you can ask about just about any political question, right? what's really going on will probably include something about Russia. So that's the first order of business, is to find out what's really going on. And that's difficult, because what's really going on is incredibly complex, especially at high levels of like statecraft. So by choosing this political intrigue, you've chosen, well, I don't know wisely or poorly, but certainly a complex question, because it's difficult to even figure out what's going on in this situation. And that's one thing that probably as Christians we should be well aware of. It's called humility. We don't know as much as we think we know, especially given the ubiquity of social media and 24-hour news cycles and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We think we know, and we know so much that we're often morally incapable of doing anything, because we just get this overwhelming sort of drinking from a fire hose amount of information. But it turns out that we still don't know that much. So what's really going on is the first question that's difficult to know. And the second question is, what is the moral question here? So what is a moral question about the impeachment of the president? What do you think? Huh? Okay, so are you talking about the Congress or the president at this point?
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right. Anybody else? What do you think the real what is the moral question here? Now, I want to clue you in or give you one hint on how we might approach this by recalling way back in the first week where I said that ethics is a discipline of practical reason, which means that it terminates not in just a contemplation of truth, but in an action. So the question is, what is to be done? Right? So there's a political question. What is to be done? Are we to impeach? Well, at this level, the we here is not us. Right? So we're asking, should Congress impeach? Now, we can also start running that as a case and say, is that a moral question or not? Maybe, because there's a question about responsibility. Are they exercising the authority that they're given? Are they required to exercise it, right? I read one thing this week, said, look, it's not a legal responsibility that Congress has to impeach the president. It's a political responsibility. And so if the Congress chooses not to impeach even a president who gravely violates the law, is there a real abdication of duty there? If it's not a legal responsibility. I don't know. I mean, this is certainly not up to me. I'm just telling you there are different ways of thinking about this, right? And none of them are what we're trying to get at. So the question here for us is, what is to be done? Who is to do it? When it comes to a moral question, right? What is it like? So rather than like pushing this out even further, let me suggest the following as a real moral question, okay? So I think that for a wide range of Christian ethicists and theologians, the real genius of the Founding Fathers would be not in their understanding of liberty, say borrowed from the French or something, but in their understanding of human frailty. And by human frailty, I mean that humans will inevitably, almost to a person, do really bad things when given lots of power, right? And so what the founders did was institute in a really important way a balance of powers as a check against the overreach of human will, the will to dominate. The reason I say that, I think that Christian ethicists and theologians from a wide variety of perspectives would probably agree on that, is because it's a pretty deeply Christian understanding. They think that humans are not just good by nature, but fallen. We will do bad things. We do bad things even when they don't make sense. And so politics at its best restrains us at our worst. And so what's going on, at least at a sort of quasi-moral level here, the question we can ask with the impeachment is this contributing to the strengthening of the balance of powers? And it might seem like the obvious answer is yes, right? Because this is one branch of government that has been at least less than effective and probably like completely ineffective at actually exercising the role that it's supposed to, right? The Congress. And so exercising any authority at all over the executive branch is just in itself a win. That seems obvious. And that's not a partisan statement. I mean, this is a long time in the making, right? Like, we could talk about the history of the decline of the legislative branch or whatever, but so that's one thing. But here's the other sort of problem, which is to say that politics doesn't just begin at the level of the state. It goes all the way down to the institutions that we exist in. We are, in Aristotle's famous maxim, political animals. So everything that we exist in is a political arena in some way or another. This church is a polity. It has boards, people who exercise power, money that goes in a certain way and another, right? All of these sorts of things. So people exercise authority. And that is why I said we don't want to throw away, just because there are asymmetries of power, we don't want to throw away the idea of power at all. But more, power is a really broad and sort of unhelpful concept. Here's what I want to suggest. What's really at stake here is the ability to trust, and not just trust, but to build institutions that make our lives possible. We can't live good lives without good institutions. We all inhabit institutions. Institutions at our work, institutions that are schools. For those of us who work in schools, that collapses, right? It's the same thing. School and an institution. And as Americans, we are really bad at trusting institutions to begin with, right? We started as a country who sort of revolted against institutions, and we believe in sort of the myth of westward expansion and like jumping on a horse and going out and setting up a farm by yourself away from everybody else, et cetera, et cetera. And we think that we are self-made. But institutions are absolutely basic and necessary for our flourishing as humans. So here's a moral question about the impeachment. Does the exercise of the congressional, right, of this branch of government against this one, is it more important than the continuing temptation to not trust institutions at all? Because at least 40 to 50% of the country is opposed to the impeachment, right? And they think of it as just completely politically motivated. So the continued decline of trust in our political institutions at the highest level is a real threat to our democracy. If we can't trust our political institutions, we won't invest in them. We won't believe, right? We don't believe in them, so we certainly won't like invest in them in terms of like going out and like trying to campaign and vote and that sort of stuff. So here's the moral question on the table. What's more important? The Congress exercising the authority that it's supposed to, its actual responsibility, or the possible continued decline of trust in our political institutions that the impeachment could bring about? All right, discuss amongst yourselves. All right, about one more minute. All right, let's finish up. Okay, I have to let you go in 1 minute. So let's find out what you have to say. Hello? All right. So let's go table by table. Let's go table by table. We've got 1 minute here, okay? 1 minute. What say you? Pass. All right. A very engaged American citizenry over here. Table two. Man. Table three. All right, table four. Huh? Believe in the institution, so you should not impeach. Hmm? Yeah, so this is one way that case studies work is that they make you choose right now. So the strong desire when you're doing case studies is to say, well, what if there's like a different thing that we don't know about? But the way that it works is to say, no, you have to choose between this and this, right? And they're like, what? I mean, I can't make any of you choose because you're not actually my students. But my students, like, I have to tell them, like, when I'm teaching bioethics and the question is, well, should we do this that has this life and death consequence, or should we do this that has this life and death consequence? Like, what if there's a third option? I say, that's not a choice for you, right? All right, so this table.
We digress.
All right, so well done, everyone. You can answer now. Oh, you figured it out? What if the thing that keeps, so impeach on it, what if the thing, the rationale here, for those of you who might not have been able to hear it, is that if there's something that rises to the level that, like, it keeps you up at night, like, it's so wrong, it keeps you up at night, and you have a course of action in front of you, you take it, and you let the chips fall where they may. What if the thing that keeps you up at night is the way a political ruler in, I don't know, say, Iraq, treats his citizens or subjects? You have a course of action in front of you, and that course of action is to invade Do you still stand by that logic? That's not our country, but it is a problem that keeps you up at night, and you do have the authority to do something about it. All right, that'll be sort of what we talk about next week when we talk about war. Not exactly that, but just want to share that form of moral reasoning can justify a lot. All right, everybody, have a good week.